You're listening to Real Talk on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
You're on Reality Check Radio. It's Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. Remember, you can send us a text at 2057. Email me, inbox at realitycheck.radio. We love getting your messages. We love getting your emails. They're always wonderful. And then we got one that was sent widely to friends and colleagues. And it's brutally honest. Oh, my goodness. And it goes like this. Wife walks in the door. Hey, darling, how was your day? Wife sits down. Honey, I'm taking myself off to the hospital because I'm a chronic alcoholic. I pissed blood at work today, and everything in my body aches in ways I've never felt before, and I know it's because of my drinking. That was Maddie Jessup, who joins us now this morning. Good morning, Maddie.
Good morning, Rodney.
Man, that's tough.
Yes, it was. It was.
How did you become an alcoholic?
I would say culture obviously helps. Background, growing up, blaming a lot of things, definitely. I suppose that's one of the first things that they try and teach you at rehab.
What do you mean by blaming?
Blaming events in your life, blaming other people, blaming the world being hard on you, blaming what I heard a very good saying a little while ago, change it from why is this happening to me to why is this happening for me. That helped with a massive, massive shift, because I absolutely have thought like that for a very long time.
Mm.
Life events, things.
You told me just before we came on here that you're 41, you're a young man, you look extremely fit, you look handsome, you look healthy, and if I saw you in the street, I'd think everything's going your way.
We like that sometimes with people, though, aren't we? That's definitely something I've discovered in the last few years, is that a lot of us wear a face in day-to-day life and what have you. Thanks for that. I didn't always look like this at all. It's kind of nice to be able to see these pop-up memories on Facebook. Not that I'm a big fan of Facebook. These pop-up memories come up and what I used to look like and what I do now, which obviously strengthens the resolve. But, yeah, my veins and capillaries and whatnot went back into my face, and my face started having a bit of structure and so on and so
wow.
forth. It's new to me, to be honest. It's new to me.
And when you sat your wife down and admitted that you were a chronic alcoholic and that you were pissing blood, she had no idea?
She knew. I say to people, well, because obviously this is a very common question, that one. I think that she knew about give or take maybe a third, definitely less than a half of it. I was hiding a lot. I was a very, as you read in that bio, I was a very calculating, deceitful alcoholic. I prided myself in being able to hide it, so I drank white spirits and masked it with anything, our foods and bits and pieces that you can, which we get good at when you're under the influence of something that takes control of you, or I was out of control. And I would eat the foods that I knew would mask it. I prided myself on not getting caught. It was almost like a game. I know that sounds a bit crass, but it's kind of true.
Obviously, when you're a young boy becoming a young man, you drink.
Yes.
You learn to drink.
Got good at it too.
you're in a culture when it's a thing that you do, you drink. Did it happen then that you drank more than everyone else, or is it something that grew?
No, it grew. It definitely grew. I was able to, when I was younger, I would go, you know, your typical Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday night, and then I'd feel like I'd achieved or whatever, you know, earned to be able to have a drink on a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And then that slowly encroached back onto the Wednesday and back to the Tuesday and back to the Monday. And all of a sudden you're drinking every day of the week, just drinking a bit less on the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And then it all became a bit more fluid. The whole lot became, every day. I didn't drink at work. I could actually count that on probably one hand, how many times I drank at work, but I was always anxious to finish, and I would always be either on the way to the alcohol shop or pulling the vodka out from underneath the seat of the driver's seat. And then all of a sudden the pattern would continue, and I was constantly holding it at bay. I was always aware of it. I was always aware that I'd feel sick the next day, and so on and so forth. It just grew and grew and grew. And then COVID, I held it under control. I held the game under control until COVID.
We'll get to that. So for what? How many years did alcohol rule your life? Like, when did it start to become, you got to have a drink?
Have to would be early 30s.
And you were married then with children?
I had children, but I wasn't quite married yet. I had one child. I had one child at 30. I have two more now, younger. So I had one beautiful daughter from a previous relationship when I was younger. And then I met my now mother of my children. I've been coached not to say ex-wife. because it actually it's made a bit of a shift when I stopped calling her that. I call her the mother of my children now. We get on really well. I didn't have kids. I had my oldest then, but I hadn't really settled into family life, if that's sort of what you mean.
Yes. But you've got a wife now.
No, I don't. No.
Okay. So the wife you sat down to say, honey, I'm an alcoholic, is no longer your wife.
Yes, that's correct.
Got it. And how long ago did you sit down and say that to her?
March the 11th, 2021. So it was 3 days after I stopped. I'd stopped drinking. And she wouldn't have known what was going through my head for 3 days. I would have been, I was shaking and hiding and drenched the bed. I went and slept in a different bed because the withdrawals were, I just made out like I was staying up late at night. The withdrawals were really, really intense. And I drenched a double bed top and bottom for 3 nights in a row. And it was the going to the loo at work on the Wednesday that really freaked me out. And I'd already been pre-contemplating, they call it that in the meetings. I'd already been pre-contemplating that I was way over the top, that I'd been for a long time too. I'd been beating myself up, and the game wasn't as much fun anymore for the last year. And it was just, I suppose it was just something needed to push me over the edge, and it took that to do it.
The blood.
Yeah.
And how much would you drink?
I would go through 1.5, 2 bottles. I'll say one and a half bottles of vodka a week, and then I would chase that down with high percentage beer. So I would get in the car. I would arrive home starting to be cut. So I'd finish work and I'd be drinking on the way home. And then when I would get home, I wouldn't have anything on my breath because it would just be vodka. And I would do a few things around the house. It would all be always on my mind. I'd be doing a few things around the house and I would appear to be I was always an active dad and partner, but I would make myself go and do the dishes, do the laundry, get a few things prepared. And then I'd, oh God, I feel like a beer. Well, I mean, it was all a facade. I'd already had vodka. I'd already had maybe a beer in the car or whatever. And then I would just hold it at bay for a little while to make it appear like I'd gotten home and didn't need one immediately. But I'd already had some, and I wasn't, and I'd maintain my composure. Obviously I got very, very controlled, with my language and talking and everything. It was always on my mind.
It's like having a mistress.
It was very much so that I had to hide, but I was proud of at the same time. It was very, very, very strange to look back on. It's very strange
because you're getting away with it.
Because I was getting away with it. And while I wasn't aching before my body, before, you know, funds in the bank and before any struggles and bits and pieces, it was a game. I prided myself on winning. And it wasn't until, the last year that everything started. I just went right downhill and couldn't, I say I wasn't in control anyway, but I really couldn't control it the last year.
And when you're at a, and when you're at a party and there's drink, would you get drunk that people would notice, or were you just constantly sort of topped up and people didn't notice?
In that time of the year, you know, you're going through your 30s and what have you, a heavy drinking culture, and I was a Westie. So I suppose that's a very short press picture, but it's easy enough for some people. I was always pretty controlled when I was drinking. Even when I was drunk, I was semi in control. I could still behave. I wasn't really injuring myself all that often. I'd still do some silly things and whatnot, but I was always a pretty controlled drinker. I was never known to get out of hand and what have you. I'd always clean up. I was a very, very very deceitful, well-behaved, my wife would call it a high-functioning drunk.
And your job, was it a physical job or sitting in an office?
Physical, a bit of both, but physical.
And you could always manage that?
Yes, I could. I actually had a couple of job changes in between it being hard like that, but then I went back to school to become an apprentice. A builder's apprentice.
Yeah.
So I used to be a cabinet maker and a shop fitter and a sign maker, and then I went back to school to become a builder.
Yeah.
And by the time everything started falling apart, so what you're sort of asking, I would turn up on a Monday morning. By the end, I was turning up on a Monday morning and running out the back of the garage or the house or that we were building or whatever, and I would be going to have a spew, not because I had been drinking, more because I hadn't had a drink. And like, I mainly spewed when I hadn't had a drink. It was withdrawals that would make me spew.
Sorry to be so intrusive.
I don't mind. I would like people to be able to gain some utility from this. That's why I did it.
Because there's a lot of mystery about alcoholism. And there's people that drink a lot that aren't alcoholics. There's people that go to parties and get drunk and they're not alcoholics. And then there's people like you that no one knows. I had a friend like this. I had two friends, actually. Never knew. Never, ever knew that they were exactly like you, that they were constantly drinking secretly and were extremely good at it. One was an MP. And I don't think he'd mind me saying his name. His name was Mark Peck. He's admitted to it publicly. And he was a lovely, lovely man, a very good member of parliament, very, very hardworking. And he was an out-of-control alcoholic. And I would literally see him a lot because we were on the same select committees. He was chairman of a select committee that I was on. And I never felt I could ask him about it because he came out and admitted it. He had a bad car crash. They tested him. And it's been a mystery to me, Maddie, right, that it's not what you necessarily think. It's not the guy. It's not the guy in the coat wandering the streets, picking rubbish out of the bin and going off or robbing an alcohol store for booze. It's someone like yourself who's working, got a family, and there you are, totally building your whole life around alcohol, right? Do you think it's a genetic thing?
Well, I would say that's it's very easy for me to think that. I mean, I haven't gone deep into the science of alcoholism because I feel like a scientist on alcoholism already.
Yeah.
I think there was a time when I had alcohol dependence and alcohol, and I was a problem drinker. And I think that, to be honest, I actually think that those terms are very useful. I know plenty of people who don't drink until the weekend. And then when they do, they drink and get out of hand and use it as a – we use it. I used it. I don't want to speak for other people. I'll speak for me. I had all of the different types. I was a problem drinker. I was a dependent and I was an alcoholic and at different stages. And I use those terms independently because I think that you can still – us can still be problem drinkers before we actually become dependent or an alcoholic. Like it can still affect us and make us do silly things and even if we manage to hold it off until once a month, I think that we're all still capable of doing. I certainly was, and I certainly saw plenty of it. But then the dependent part, the actual addiction part, and the need, the cravings, the anxiety for a drink and what have you, that's further towards the end. Also the cloak or the invincibility cloak or whatever people want to call it, to be able to dance on a dance floor. I mean, I can't dance to save myself when I'm not drunk. And now I would like to go to dancing classes, to be honest, to be able to dance like I once thought that I was able to.
Yeah.
So you use, yeah, using it as a confidence. What do they call it? Liquid confidence.
It's a lot of money you've spent on booze.
A phenomenal amount of money.
And that would be hard to manage and hide.
Yes, although I'm obviously, hard to manage and hide, but I'm very philosophical about it now because I've done so many things in the last 3 years that I wouldn't have done if I didn't go through all of that. So
how wonderful.
Obviously it's easy to, of course I've toyed with the idea of how much I've spent on it before, but it just gets, I mean, obviously there's no utility in that after you've thought about it a few times because it's hundreds of thousands of dollars.
And obviously you'd be driving drunk.
Yes.
Did that worry you you'd get caught?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, and I was very calculating. That doesn't mean that I was immune from getting caught, but Well, you get very good at it. You know when the cops are going to be on the road or not, or having stops or not. And I was very, very confident at getting away with it. And it doesn't mean that obviously I could have been caught at any stage. But, the cognitive dissonance started to hit me in the face a little bit when I would pick up my kids from kindy or whatever, and I would already have drunk when I finished work. And then I would go and pick up the kids from kindy or from wherever I had to pick them up, and I'd be strapping them into their car seats and thinking, I'm doing this to keep my kids safe and I'm drunk and I know you're drunk, Matt, you're drunk and yet you're putting your kid's car seat on. This is so counter to this is, yeah. And I started, obviously you learn the term cognitive dissonance at some stage in your life and you realize exactly what that is when you're honest with yourself, and that started to really eat me for the last for the last few months, I couldn't shake that every time I picked them up, and I was in that state. It would do my head in.
When you were drunk like this, because you're constantly drunk, was it impairing your driving, or is it just that you were so used to it that you could drive okay?
I would say yes to both.
Okay.
It was definitely impairing me, and I'm honest about it now, 100% definitely impairing me. But I would say yes to both the things that you just said.
And your workmates never knew?
Well, but again, shifting jobs by the end. So the people that I worked with at the end we didn't actually drink at work. The guys that I worked with were a bit more straight and narrow. Fantastic company that I worked for up in Northland. They weren't big drinkers. Even when we had work dues and stuff, we would all drive to the place, and everybody would drive back home after. They'd only have two beers at the restaurant or wherever we were at the most over the space of, you know, 2 hours at a Christmas do or wherever we were. They weren't drinking, so we'd all turn up in our own cars. I think I was the only one out of them that would do that. I think I can say that it was only me that would end up actually driving home drunk, but I would have turned up. I would have turned up half cut anyway to those sorts of things.
So you admit to your wife that you're a chronic alcoholic. You were peeing blood. You took yourself off to the hospital. Then what?
I came the very next day. At that time, I decided that was me, that I wasn't going to, and I wanted to start a path of sobriety, I suppose. All the reasons for my kids, they were the biggest reason. They obviously, I wish that it had gotten to me earlier, obviously, the stopping bit, I mean. I was rung by, after the hospital, they told me that I'd be contacted by some specialists. And I ended up getting a couple of phone calls and having a couple of very long phone interviews with some psychologists. And they were phone interviews, again, because of COVID. They were phone interviews, and I would speak to them for about 45 minutes while we decided what my path was going to be. And then I started attending Odyssey House meetings on a Wednesday night. And I got immediately started to find some resolve and really wanting to not drink. And it was after the first couple of meetings. Well, first meeting was incredible, and then after the
first... Tell me why it was incredible.
Because I walked into the place and sat down, nobody had seen me before, so they were all regulars or semi-regulars. They all knew each other, everybody at the table, big table up in Whangarei. And there's all walks of life. When I walked in, there was, you know, every skin colour. There was gangsters, there was government employees, there was old, young. No, obviously it immediately looked clear to me that nobody was safe from addiction. But I was I'd dressed a little bit. I looked clean cut and what have you, and I felt a little bit clean cut. And I walked in and I was so arrogant. I felt like I wasn't one of them. I felt like I wasn't one of these people. And as soon as I started hearing their stories around the table, because they're one of the first questions that they would ask at these meetings is, how was your last week? And people would just talk about their last week as it went around the table. And it became very quickly apparent that I was very much so one of these people. And, like I wrote, there really is nothing quite like watching somebody stare into their cup of tea. They get you to make a cup of tea. I think that's because you've got something to hold and warm, wrap your hands around and be active with or whatever while you're going through the meeting. And I, there really is nothing like watching somebody stare into their cup of tea while they rattle off all the ways that they've deceived family and friends and what they've done with Yeah, and it really hit me hard because some of the things that they said, that they were crying about and in tears about, some of the things that, I mean, I'd done worse, a lot of it. It hit me like a ton of bricks in the first meeting, which was obviously quite powerful for the rest of them. They'd all seen it before, you know, people turning up and thinking that they were all that. Falling apart or lowering their veil or whatever you want to call it.
Wow.
In the meeting, it was very, very powerful, that first one.
That honesty must be shocking to hear.
I don't think it was shocking to the people in the group. It wasn't shocking to the people in the group. They'd heard a lot before. The honesty for me, sorry? Yes, very much so. And one of the guys was, these guys would talk about the feelings that you get from sharing the you know, neurochemical releases that in your brain when you share things that and getting off your chest and what have you. And I felt it big time. I felt it hugely. It felt like a massive, massive weight off my shoulders that very first meeting. And I had to go back. And I don't know if people have seen that movie Fight Club, where
yes,
Edward Norton goes and he starts going to all these meetings because he's feeling those feelings and just wants to get a hug, and he goes to meetings for things that he doesn't even have.
Yes.
I started to understand that.
The first night you turned up to Odyssey House in Whangarei, did you share or was it too tough for you?
No, I wasn't going to. They told me I didn't have to. They were going around the circle and they were, it's okay, you don't have to on your first time, mate. And then I did. I did end up at the very, very end. I put my hand up and said, actually, I'd like to. So it skipped me as it went round, and I said, I can't do this. And they said, it's okay, mate. And it carried on going around the group. And then at the end, after I'd heard everybody's story and realised that I don't know, maybe in a safe place, I put my hand up and started sharing.
That must have been, as you say, a huge weight off your shoulders, because for years and years and years, you'd been deceiving loved ones.
Yes, it was. It was huge. It made me, for want of a better term, it made me look forward to the next week, the next meeting.
To be there again and share.
Yeah. And then after the second one, that was me. I went every week diligently, nonstop. Without a break. When I say nonstop, I went without a break for 23 weeks.
And was it the same people each week, or were they coming and going?
People still had schedules. There was some people that weren't able to because they had work that they still had to or whatever, and then they would come back the next week or on the third and they'd tell us how they were. Or I mean, there was, like I say, there was some government employees, council-type people who had to travel, and they'd be down in the South Island or they'd be overseas, and then they weren't able to make the next week. And then they'd come back 2 weeks later or 3 weeks later and talk about how much they'd struggled for the last weeks. Yes, very much so. Yeah, there was plenty of the same
people. And the struggle had been particularly hard for them because they hadn't had the support of their peers in the Odyssey group for that weekly session.
I think we've all got our own. It's hard to speak for anyone else because I know that it's very different for a lot of people because I get approached now about this. I get talked to about this by friends, and I'm absolutely an open book about it. And I don't ever want to be one of these classed as or boxed as a reformed alcoholic who's now better than anybody else, because I'm not. This is my battle for the rest of my life. It's a battle, and I've got to keep to it. I never ever think to myself that I'm safe. I could easily, if something could happen in my life, I can't say that it won't. So I have to keep it in check all the time. So the term, it's very easy to feel like, well, people stop talking to you as much. You stop getting invited to parties. You stop getting asked around on the Friday evening and the Saturday to people's places and rung up to go and do things because, well, I'm guessing that people want to be able to see themselves when they have a drink, want to be able to relax and let their veil down and what have you. And I wasn't doing that now. And I don't know what goes through other people's heads when I'm at a party and I'm not drunk and they are. And I know that it makes me less approachable to some people, or they feel not, I'm not less approachable. I'm definitely not. I'll give anybody the time of day, but I know that that makes a lot of people feel less approachable. I used to feel it myself when somebody would stop drinking and you'd be talking to them and you couldn't, you couldn't do or say or speak or be the way that you wanted to.
I know about this because at different times of my life, I've been a heavy, what I'd call social drinker. And when I became an MP, it was like alcohol drenched. Everywhere you went, there was booze. And I love eating. I love putting things in my mouth. I love the feel. And I love drinking. I'd drink too much lemonade. I'd drink too much beer. I'd drink too much wine. I didn't drink spirits. But every function, there'd be alcohol. You'd go to fly home and you'd go into the Coro Club and be sitting with other MPs and have a wine. And I'd always have more than most, I felt. In those days, you'd get on the plane and they'd serve you drinks. And then you'd get back to Auckland and you'd go to a function, there'd be drinks, and you'd get a taxi. And then I just got sick of it. And I felt my nose, I was a bit nothing like you, but I felt my nose getting red. And I just got sick of it. And I had a summer break from Parliament. I never drank. And I felt, I just don't want to go back there and drink. So I just decided, literally going down to Wellington, I'm just not going to drink. And it became such a thing for everyone. Oh, go on, have a drink. Go on, have a drink. I don't want to drink. I'm going to have a week off drinking. And it became such a thing, people forcing it upon you. And then I felt like you, I just never got invited anywhere. And I ended up having to build an entire new activity and way of relaxing. So you'd go to the gym and you'd end up with friends who weren't drinkers. And so instead of sitting around drinking after work, I'd go to the gym and my friends would be at the gym. And I found it extremely tough. And I thought, imagine if I was an alcoholic. Because it's not just losing your mistress, it's losing your social life and all these activities that you've just fallen into doing. So you had that.
Yeah, very much so. Yes, very much so. And then you have to I don't say find yourself, because I'm not going and finding myself. You've got to create yourself. Somebody said to me the other day, you're paving your own yellow brick road in front of you.
Yeah.
And I just thought it was beautiful. That totally resonated with me, because I'm not going out and finding myself. I'm creating myself. Yeah, I'll leave it at that.
So you went to Odyssey House every week religiously.
Yeah.
Through this time, you would still be around alcohol?
Yeah.
But you'd go to a party?
No, I didn't go to I tried going to a party after about 4 months, and I managed it. It was good. It was a good test. I got home, and I was happy that I'd went and what have you, but it was very, very tough. I didn't go to another one for a while. I was very happy that I went and relieved that I hadn't had a drink and test myself. It felt like a test that I'd made myself and passed myself. And then I didn't go to one for quite a while until I started feeling a little bit more comfortable in my own skin. And then I did start to test myself a little bit more. Again, it was hard for quite a while. And now it took probably about eight, somewhere between a year and 18 months to actually lose a lot of those need feelings and anxiety feelings around it. But then, well, you start getting up in the morning without feeling like that, and you like really quickly getting up in the morning and going and doing and being and starting to appreciate different things in life and what have you. Become quite philosophical about it all.
Not having to be deceitful.
Exactly. And I mean, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for it. I mean, I wouldn't have done, there's so many things that I've done in the last 3 years that I would never have done if I hadn't become an alcoholic. So I'm very, very philosophical about it. Yes. I've changed in a lot of ways. I don't begrudge the money I've spent on it, although it makes me obviously, I don't begrudge anything, but I'm very, very fortunate to be able to say that I didn't become one of the major negative social statistics.
Yeah.
With it, I thank whoever it is, I thank actually quite regularly that I didn't, because I know it could have been that. It could have been a car crash. It could have been serious injury or death in any number of ways. I could have drunk myself. I could have actually drunk myself off. There's all sorts of things I could have done. And I absolutely don't ram it down people's throats. But I let everybody know that I'm there if they need someone. And I wouldn't have been able to say that before.
And you haven't had a drink since?
No, not at all.
And if you had one beer, you'd be back to it, wouldn't you?
Yeah, can't touch it.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
So good on you. You're an inspiration.
Thanks.
And how's your life changed being sober?
Well, I got fit. There's a few periods while I was a heavy drinker that I was actually very heavy drinker that I went through some major fitness phases and I got very fit. But it wasn't until I stopped drinking that the veins, capillaries, and everything, and then my face started to look a bit more chiseled or whatever. The fat started.
Yeah, you look great. Yeah,
and I started to be able to exercise lighter. It was easy on the knees. I didn't get gout. Because I was a major gout problem. And the money would be in the bank, worry less, anxiety less. Yeah, all sorts. More reliable. I love being able to be relied on now. Like, I wasn't able to be relied on. I like being able to volunteer myself to be able to pick people up, drop people off. I like being able to go to parties and not worry about how I'm getting home. It was very, very good for me. My kids, again, I was always an engaged dad, a very engaged dad, I think. I think I always was, always have been, I hope. But it changed when I stopped drinking. It all became much more real. It was all the focus and so on and so forth. Actually, one of the main things I noticed was, one of the biggest things I noticed was when I, you know, when your kids are playing up and you try and figure them out, and be able to get them past whatever it is that's making them frustrated or upset or whatever. I've always tried to do that. But even when I was drinking, I'd always try and do that, but I'd give up after one or two tries and I'd just let them, you know. When I stopped drinking, I had more tricks up my sleeve, more perseverance, more, and I'm not like a naggy dad. I mean, like I'd just be more, fascinating, getting into my kids' heads and trying to actually, like, I had more resolve and I was more keen and I had more time for them. And I'll think about this after I've spoken to you, actually, because that was a biggie. That was huge.
Well, it's a funny thing, isn't it? Because I'm imagining if you're an alcoholic, you're deceiving your kids.
Very much so.
And you're putting them in the baby seat, driving drunk and feeling like a shit. and hating yourself and not being the father you would like to be for your children. And now you're on the other side of it and you're a dad fully and can be proud of yourself and can be relied upon and can look after them and you can keep them safe. That must be a wonderful feeling.
I actually don't think I'd been proud of myself before I did it. Ever, really, now that I look back. I mean, moments, momentarily proud, spikes of proud, but, you know, little bits and pieces. But in terms of like a real feeling, something tangible that's like longer lasting and what have you, that I'd never felt that before.
No.
So, yeah, and things, and you stick to it, and people start to notice, and then you start to feel it, and you start to feel it, and people start to notice. And yes. Then that becomes a cycle, and then it's a train I don't want to get off.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
But every day you still have to fight it.
No, I don't actually anymore. I say it's a battle that I will still be in for the rest of my life as a little, you know, the little devil or the little monkey or whatever people want to call it, that can natter at you when you have tough times and what have you. But it's always in the background, but I know I've got tools. I mean, when I went to rehab, they give you a lot of tools. I would definitely suggest this to, I would absolutely suggest this to anybody who's thinking of giving up. Doing it on your own is absolutely fantastic and very, very admirable. But until you get tests, so it's when you get tested, you want to have as many tools as you can in your toolbox. And so many of those tools for me came from the meetings.
Yes.
So I think it's incredible when people say that they were able to give up drinking by themselves or without help and so on and so forth. But I would be, I'm personally, for me, that's not good enough for me. I need as many tools in that toolbox, like I say, as possible to be able to draw from whenever I get tempted and what have you. And some of the things that they teach you in those meetings, I mean, some of that stuff that they taught us, I've come to believe should be taught to us before you end up an alcoholic. But I mean, some of it's just incredible. And it very, very...
Like what?
Life, skills, tricks. Again, this is going to be something that I'll think about when we get off, when we finish here. But pathways in your brain to be able to put off things that time limits, little tricks to find out for you that are specific for you. And you don't find out these things unless you've become vocal and actually and speak about them,
yes.
Not just to yourself.
Speaking is so important, isn't it? To say it,
yes,
out loud.
Well, then you become accountable.
Yes.
So one of my tricks when I got a major urge was to tell somebody. I would ring somebody up. If I got a major urge at home, I would ring somebody up and tell them, because it immediately alleviated my desire to drink. I was accountable on the phone with somebody that I was ringing. Hey, I haven't told you this, but I took myself off possible, blah, blah, blah. I'm a full-on alcoholic, and I'm actually just having a craving at the moment, and I'm run out of people now.
Well, you can ring me. Ring me. Tell me, if you came round to my place for a barbecue and everyone there is having a beer and I say, oh, Maddie, here's a beer, what would you say to me?
No, thanks, Matt. I'm not drinking today, or I'm not drinking at the moment, or whatever. I never say it on the first comment now. I don't say I'm an alcoholic, I don't drink, because that changes people. The whole mood,
yes,
of the conversation changes and what have you. I'll just say, no, thanks, man. I've got to be somewhere. I've got to do this or that or whatever. And if they pry, I'll say I'm actually, I don't, because if I start, I won't know when to stop. And I'm bubbly about it.
Yeah.
And then if people want to push the conversation and they ask questions, then I'll tell them. But I don't ram it down people's throats at all. Nobody wants to hear it. It doesn't do any good for me either.
The circle that you're in Odyssey House when you're tuning up there, Does that stay in that circle in Odyssey House, or do you talk and ring each other and support each other out of that circle, or is it the circle of trust just at that moment being so important?
Oh, some people kept in contact with each other. I definitely had a few phone calls with a few people.
Yes.
There, backwards and forwards, and I know that that would be the same for some people. It's the same with any kind of meeting or relationship or relationships and so on and so forth. If you develop a relationship with people in there and you end up being able to have somebody friendly to be able to call on, then great. But, I mean, it'd be each to their own.
I'm a little sad about this, and you don't need to answer the question if it's difficult, but I'm sad that your marriage broke up, because it seemed to me you'd got to a better place.
I obviously, part of me thinks that I don't think I'll get in trouble for saying this by the mother of my children. COVID shone a headlight.
Oh, well, let's go into that. Let's talk COVID about COVID. Because this is the second part of your story to us, is COVID. So let's do COVID. And
so
maybe
COVID shone a headlight on our existing problems. I definitely can't blame our breakup on COVID. I can't blame it. I've got so much responsibility to take for this. But yeah, COVID shone a big headlight on some of our existing problems, and we didn't get past them.
How did COVID do that?
We had a lot of, this might sound familiar to some people, we had a lot of people in positions on both sides of our family, in medical positions, media positions, all sorts of different positions on both sides of our family that, well, it was unpalatable to make the decisions that we did around not taking the vaccine. So I get out of hospital, and mandates started being talked about within a couple of weeks, and I have always been I've always called myself 100% pro-vaccination, but 100% against compulsory vaccination. Yes. That's been my stance for a very, very, very long time, and I've been vocal about it because, I mean, there's people out there that can die from eating half a peanut.
Yeah.
So why on earth would you just go widespread and go and give something new and unpredictable to a whole heap of people? So my ears were a bit pricked and primed when all of that happened. And so I had a little bit of a peak. So this is in the weeks and months after hospital. You started hearing about people's aggravated organs and the vaccine was aggravating some things in some people. And when I found out that that was happening to people's liver and kidneys, well, I was obviously very scared about this. My body had only just stopped throbbing. So I started looking into it, and then that became both sides of my wife and I had people on both sides of our family. That was not a very that wasn't a palatable decision for a lot of people.
So your wife was on board with you not getting jabbed?
My wife came on board with me not getting jabbed. So Linda Horton, wasn't she fantastic?
Yes.
The New Zealand, the Health Forum was where I started looking into, and then you started seeing a whole heap of people who had mums and in particular, it was the mums, obviously, and I would show my wife at the time. So she saw that there was another side that we weren't being told. You know, there was a lot of people in those threads talking about the things that were going on with the jabs and what have you. So we paused. Our default position became, we're not going to get it, we're going to wait. And then we had a couple of friends close to us who got very, very sick from it. Directly afterwards, and I'm talking people in their mid-30s who got very, very crook from the vaccine, and that made us put a stop on, it went from default position no to no. And then our, well, everyone's got their own version of this, but to cut a long story short, yeah, life got flipped upside down. Yeah.
How?
We stopped getting invited to things that meant a lot to us, to family events that were very close to us. I mean, in proximity, geography, I mean, very close. and family members very close. And then, well, I could go. That's a big topic. How far do you want to go?
All the way.
Okay. So we started doing our home. I started digging, I suppose. If I'm to speak, I'll use metaphors to speed it up. I feel like I look back now and I feel like the first time that I went down the rabbit hole, which I don't have a problem saying that anymore. Actually, it's not a rabbit hole. It's a rabbit warren. The first time that I went down the rabbit hole, which was not too long after I stopped drinking and they started talking about mandates and I wanted to find out more about it, and because they were talking about children as well. So, of course, I went down the rabbit hole and I got, let's say, for want of a better term, I spat myself out after a couple of weeks, and I looked around and saw people, and I knew we were being lied to. So I look in for a couple of weeks. I know that we're being lied to. I didn't know what was true. I didn't know what was real. I didn't know what, and I'm not a scientist, and all sorts of bits and pieces, and we're all being told that we're not allowed to look if we're not a scientist anyway, but I knew we were being lied to. And I look around, and people are jabbing their kids, and I had this unbelievable, this overwhelming feeling of wanting to know more, because, well, for all the obvious reasons that lots of people did this. And then I went back down the rabbit hole for about another 2 months. And I mean, sitting up in front of the computer every single night with my dressing gown on up until 2 a.m. Now, I'm not a drinker now, so I didn't mind getting 5 hours sleep and going to work off 5 hours sleep. And I was up every night after the kids went to bed for hours and hours on end, trawling through bits and pieces, stacking up information, parking information, and stacking it up as it, taking everything on board as it stacked up or didn't. And then I started to realize that people in the community in positions of influence and power, what leaders and what I say power, influence, members of the community weren't standing up and doing anything. And I felt at the time that I had some information. I felt I had some words. I felt I had the courage. I had a new feeling of what I had a whole new feelings about all of this. And I felt capable of being able to speak up about it. When I started speaking up about it, then I got flipped again and again. And I could go anywhere from here.
Hey, Gus.
It's funny, I've been so vocal for 3 years about what happened with all of this. And now speaking to you, I've got a million different words lumping in the back of my throat to come out at the same time. Go on, ask me another question. Ask me another question to prompt me and it'll bring out something.
So with the family situation, proximity, you could no longer visit, and they were hating on you because you wouldn't take the jab and save Nana.
Well, it was strange. It wasn't that we weren't allowed to visit small groups. It was funny. Some people were obeying some rules and not others. So it would be like the parties you were not allowed to get invited to. They have a vaccine passport check at a party for people and what have you. This happened more than once. When they started talking about get jabbed to save your parents, so it was stop the spread and so on and so forth, and they were telling everybody to go and jab, that the children had to be jabbed because they were vectors of transmission, that they were this, that, and the other. And then so I started doing my homework into children. At the time they had kids the argument in the United States, so around the rest of the world, was 6 to 9 months in front of us in terms of the vaccine rollout. And so some of the arguments that I was following, in particular in the States, was centered around children's transmission ability and at school and so on and so forth, and them taking it home to their parents and whatnot. So I started looking into how children were accepting the vaccine, and I quickly discovered that any of the children that were dying that we were hearing about on the news had at least 4, if not 5, pre-existing conditions, that they were very, very sick.
The whole thing, the entire thing, was a stick of lies.
Totally.
There wasn't one lie. The whole lot was a lie. Every aspect of it.
Totally.
They were lying. And it was a monstrous evil that was inflicted on us from above. When I say that, you know, prime ministers, UN, all the way down. Devastating to communities and people's lives. Devastating for those who took the jab and suffered. Devastating for those that refused to take their jabs and lost their livelihoods, their homes, their friendships, their circles. There are splits in friendships that will never be repaired, and splits in families that will never be repaired. All over this bullshit from above. And we still haven't figured out a way, and maybe never will, to get back to where we once were.
I have to capitalise on your mentioning of people vaccine injuries there. My problems, as much as I've got problems, and I almost drew a couple of tears just then talking to you, my problems are nothing compared to so many people out there. There's some of the stories that I've heard. See, I discovered that I actually was capable of empathy, because you start looking around. I pull my head out of the viewmaster and look around, and I'm starting to see problems of people who eclipsed mine. And my problems, I thought, were massive. I thought that what I was going through was huge. If I was going through that 5 years ago, people would be going, far out, Maddie's going through a bloody hard time. But now all of a sudden you look around and there's people going through so much worse, and people who have suffered so much worse. And I started to feel it, and I wanted to speak up about it. And then I became panicked, right? So I was one of the people, definitely one of the people who went overboard. Well, I say overboard. I don't think I've actually, you know what? I look back now, it wasn't overboard.
No.
It wasn't overboard at all.
No.
But at the time, you're being accused of going overboard, right? So I start a Facebook them in messenger thread and add about 40 people on it and tell them what's happening in the world, and that we're all going to bloody, that they're trying this and they're doing that, and that they'll go and get petrol and stock up on food. And I went absolutely blimmin' crazy. And then I started seeing it'd say Joe Bloggs has left the group, so-and-so has left the group.
Yeah.
And I was, oh my God, this isn't working. People aren't listening. So I started to try and keep myself in check as I was deciphering this information. At the beginning, I was, the same as everybody, intellectually bullied out of being able to look into the medical side of things. Now, you know, you're not a medical professional, you're not allowed to look. So I started to look into legislation. I started to look into the regulatory and legislatory mechanisms that are allowing this stuff to happen. And I became very fascinated by this interchangeable, or this linguistic, it was played with around the world, but a lot of people know the term emergency use authorization.
Yes.
And that it required provisions to be able to be enacted, and that one of those provisions was that there must be no existing available treatments for COVID. And as soon as I turned my attention, very beginning, one of the things I did at the beginning of my journey was turn towards Africa, because I mean, they didn't have, their governments didn't have the money for the vaccine. And I heard of this fascinating guy called Dr. Pierre Corey, who was having great success doing some things. I don't want to go rehash everything because I know that I'll be preaching to the converted a lot here, but I heard of Pierre Corey using repurposing off-patent, off-label drugs and what have you. And then as soon as you started finding out that there were treatments, absolutely were treatments ranging from vitamin D, zinc, quercetin, ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, blah, 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 all of those things. And then you know this term emergency use authorization, and that it was only able to be enacted if there were no existing treatments, then it made perfect sense as to why those treatments suffered the furore that they did over the news and what have you. Now, I quickly became apparent that there weren't any doctors worth their salt saying that ivermectin was horse paste. It was the media saying that. Ivermectin's on the World Health Organization's list of essential medicines, for God's sake. It's one of the safest drugs in the world.
You're describing my journey and probably most of our listeners' journey.
This is nuts.
I got stuck, fascinated by how we, the emergency use also, but then also I got fascinated by death certificates and how they're put together.
Unbelievable.
Unbelievable. So as soon as you declare a disease, I can't remember, there's a word that they use, the legislative, you know, it's got to be notified, a notifiable disease. If you suspect someone died and you suspect that they might have COVID, you write it on the death certificate. You'll write heart failure, heart attack, gunshot and COVID.
Yeah.
And COVID. And then it's in the media, another COVID death. And you realized that this was entirely manufactured by deceit. And so you, and then you become this bore because of, oh, look, so shocked. You know, another, a person's died of COVID. You say, no, they haven't. Oh, yes, no, they have. I read it in the paper. Or, there's no other use, you got to get the vaccine. So what about ivermectin? Oh, no, that's horse paste. And you realize, and you become this terrible person who's trying to argue with everyone because you're so frustrated and angry about this, and they're brainwashed, propagandized. I, funnily enough, never watched TV. So I'd never seen the scare images. And one night, my family, we went on a road trip when we could, and we stopped in this motel, and there's this TV, and we turned it on. I got scared because they had people in coats, people being carried, dead people everywhere. Like, it took up half the bulletin.
So is this before the dancing clips of doctors and nurses dancing?
Oh, before that. This was them sort of dropping dead in China and having mass graves in New York. All of it was nonsense. But it was reported over and over and over. And I said to my wife, well, I understand now why people are scared, because they're watching this stuff every night. We were immune to it because we didn't watch TV or listen to the radio. And I ended up drawing a circle around my family, like a drawbridge. I pulled up a drawbridge and we're just going to keep us safe in this madness, because I realized it was a madness, and just keep my family safe. And then I discovered Voices for Freedom and the groups. And I realized what they meant to me, because I could draw up a drawbridge, but you can't survive just your family and you, right? You need more. And when I found Voices for Freedom, it was, oh, ISAT kept me sane, kept me alive, because I wasn't alone, because I felt terribly alone. And not knowing where it was going to go, not feeling any hope. And then, as you say, all goodness comes out of it, because I literally lost one set of friends and have produced a whole new set of friends. And these friends the moment you meet them, they're lifelong deep friends, because we've been through the same journey together.
That's it.
To go to the protest for a day was outside the birth of children and getting married and stuff, personal things, was the greatest experience of my life.
I agree.
Because it was human. And to go anywhere in New Zealand where they made you wear a mask, stood you on a yellow dot, keep a meter, rationed you walking into the supermarket, screamed at you, screamed at your kids if they got too close. It wasn't human.
Well, to that, well, you got me thinking of something. So I managed to make it down there. I managed to make it down there for 5 days. Four of those nights were spent in a tent down there. I'd been really vocal by this stage. When I first turned up, I hitchhiked down with a flag and my t-shirt on, and got picked up and went down.
The t-shirt for listeners is a great one. It says, "I spread missing information." Wonderful.
And I got them made. I was sponsored to go down by, I know there's a couple of wonderful people that will listen to this that I'm very thankful for, that sponsored me to go down to Wellington. They couldn't make it and themselves. And I said that I'd be active and that I'd do as much as I could. So I got given quite a bit of money to be able to go and do with whatever I pleased down at the protest. And so I took it very seriously. And I met quickly, obviously. I turned up at 1:30 in the morning and I had been given a tent, a map. I'd been sent a picture on Messenger of a map of the place with a tent. And when I turned up, the bed was made, the pillow was there, and it was right underneath the beehive. And when I woke up in the morning on the front of Parliament, I opened up my door, and it was a beautiful morning when I first woke up. I opened up the tent door and I put this big, I took a picture saying of the beehive. I took a picture saying, "Good morning, honey." And I put it up on my page and got heaps of, "Oh my God, you're down here. Oh, yeah, I get to meet you." And because we'd all become friends, lots of people had woven a friend network with the people you hadn't even met in person before. And so I met a whole heap of people. And after, a day or two, it becomes quickly apparent what the media, well, not immediately becomes apparent what the media was doing, but it really hit home after I'd met a whole heap of absolutely beautiful people, all
beautiful people.
And I got incredible experience, by the way, when you say that it was one of the most incredible days of, of times of your life. I totally agree. It was one of the most impactful times in such a short space of time. It was not one of the most impactful time in my life in such a short space of time. But when I went back to my tent one day to go get a rest, because it was very tiring, a lot of noise going on around the tent, obviously, I'd go and after meeting all of these people, I'd go and lie down in my tent to go and get a rest. And you'd open up your phone and have a look at all the things that you'd previously had a look at. And, your stuff, One News Hub and everything, is saying things that were so perverse and did not match the reality of what I was experiencing. No. It was so incredible to see them do that to all of these people while I was, and I knew it to not be true. So I went for a walk, as you say. You're going to walk straight out of there, no masks, right? You're in the protest. In the protest, and you walk off to go and do your grocery shopping or whatever. You've got to go to the supermarket at some stage. So no mask, and I'm wearing my T-shirt because I've had two of these printed. By the way, I went into a cafe with three different ideas, a local Freedom Cafe here in Matamata. Odalems, there you go. Odalems, fantastic. If anyone's ever going through Matamata, this place is fantastic, and they were absolutely incredible right throughout the whole right throughout everything. And I was walking down the streets of Wellington towards the main countdown, in the guts of it there, and everybody's looking at me, no mask, the T-shirt that says what it does. I managed to get past the security guard without getting accosted. And by the time I was in the shop, he wasn't going to come and chase me. He was only the one guy on the door, so he wasn't going to come and chase me through the shop. So I'm the only guy in the supermarket with no mask. And I went and got a bite to eat. And I went and sat down in that, I don't know the name of the area. I'm actually not particularly familiar with Wellington. But a big grass area where all of the business people and seats and everything, where all sorts of suits meet, sorts of suits. And everybody that walked into that place, and I mean very, very well-dressed, seemingly intellectual people walking in with masks on, and then they would go and sit in their group and they would take their mask off and sit in circles. And I walk in with no mask, with my T-shirt on, and I sit by myself. There's hundreds of people around. And I feel the stares start to start and people looking at me. And I just sat there calm. I hadn't had any coffee, so I wasn't anxious for anything. And I sat there and I just watched. And they watched me and I watched them, me against whatever, hundreds, me amongst hundreds, let's say, me amongst hundreds. And then these same people stood up, they put their masks back on, and they walked off in the direction that they came from. And I just couldn't believe it. It was like the Twilight Zone.
Yes, it's a good expression, the Twilight Zone, actually, isn't it?
It was absolutely absurd. And then you walk back along the street and you see you're still getting those feels and looks from people, and then you walk back into home of the Parliament grounds, and I obviously got to go and tell people what I'd experienced and what have you. But, I mean, that was just, it was just incredible.
Do you know what I couldn't get over? There's two things that really struck me. I wouldn't call myself a huggy person, but I hugged everyone and they hugged me. And because we'd been this 1 meter rule or 3 meter rule or whatever it was, that human connection really affected me. And everyone on the same, as they say these days, page. But then the next thing that shocked me, the walks of life that were there. You know, there were down and out teenage Maori kids in a tent next door to people who had hundreds of millions of dollars and everyone getting along. What hit me was I flew up, I arrived in Wellington Airport, no mask, and I go through Wellington Airport and I've been to many Eastern Bloc countries when they were still Eastern Bloc countries. But the first one I went to was East Berlin, which was a horrifying experience. And I walked through the Wellington Airport, security and all that, everyone masked up, everyone miserable, miserable, no smiles, you can't see a bit of warmth or human kindness. And I thought, this is worse than I remember East Berlin. And then walking into that parliament was like walking through Checkpoint Charlie. And it was freedom. It was human. It was being alive. And I could never, and get this right. I've said this many times on my show, but I'd been in Parliament for 15 years. I knew that place, not just physically, but I knew how Parliament works. I prided myself on how Parliament worked. I prided myself on knowing how the media work and how journalism works. I looked up to that Parliament and those journalists, and I didn't understand any of it.
So my background my family has worked for over a dozen media publications, at least. I was trying to count them this morning, actually. I got over a dozen media publications between them. So I've been around this all my life. And when I saw the way that what they were doing, like I say, going back into my tent, the words that they were using, the rigged language that they were using to paint a specific picture, and none of them were coming down, it started to make sense why, again, when people would talk about trying to get Jacinda down onto the Jacinda or any of these media people down onto the front steps to actually be able to present or say something to them, I couldn't help but think at the time, any one of us here could trip them up by asking them out a basic question, even just something to do with emergency use authorization.
Yes.
And that the risk versus reward of being asked that question on camera, whether you're Jacinda or media or whatever, and that being put out, I just thought risk versus reward, they ain't coming down. They're not coming down at all because it's far too risky. They got the status quo that they're doing at the moment is they're just going to maintain it. And I started to get very disillusioned. I became very, very disillusioned with all of these people I found as heroes. I'd grown up around all of this all my life. Some of these media heavyweights, without me naming anybody, these media heavyweights in New Zealand that I'd looked up to all of my life that now meant very little to me. The veil came off. I could use a bunch of different expressions to describe the feelings that I had about a heap of these people. And they're supposed to be our fourth estate. These people are supposed to be, you know,
they're supposed to be holding power accountable.
Exactly. And yet they were up there next to, quote, Ryan off AMA when he called Trevor Mallard Caesar standing up there, and as he was leaning on the post, I just thought, that why is the media, why is so few of the media calling this out? It was just, it was.
And there was New Zealand, BC, before COVID, and New Zealand AC after COVID, different world. We went from one world to another world.
It's a good
through
way to
one
put
it. Event. It was amazing. It's amazing. There's before COVID and after COVID, New Zealand, different place.
Very much so. And the, like you say, border crossings and what have you. I had a couple of hilarious border experiences.
You get stopped by the police going into Auckland. And they say, what are you going into Auckland for? And you feel like saying, bugger off, it's none of your business. But you sit there and you think, I've got to get in to catch a plane. And you're sitting explaining to them that you're flying. Oh, wow, that's okay. And then you drive into Auckland. It was a ghost town.
Well, I was in Northland at the time. My daughter, my oldest daughter, was living in Auckland. And when that big lockdown happened where we weren't allowed to do anything for months, I didn't see my now 18-year-old. She's 15 then. Didn't take it. She got kicked out of everything that she was doing, scouts and whatnot. All of the things. I hadn't seen her in 3 months, and I went down to the northern border, which was just above Wellsford, and I pulled over on the side of the road facing south, and I was so excited. I mean beyond excited. I hadn't seen her in 3 months. So I got out of the car, and this place by this stage looked like something out of what I'd seen in movies, a modern version of East Germany or whatever.
Dystopian, right?
Totally. Spotlights in the middle of the road facing down at everything, big diggers that had used to move and stop, and cone trucks and huge all sorts of contraptions to be able to manage all of the people that were managing the spot and all of this sort of thing. So me, very polite, my hands in front of me, I walked very, very, very politely up to go and inspect what it was all about. And one of the wardens who was taking people's names as they were at the people who were being checked to go north that had whatever exemptions, quote-unquote exemptions, and this woman turns to me and screams in front of everybody, with cops holding them that had guns on their sides and stuff, and screams at me, get back in your bubble. And I'm out in the open in farmland, standing in the middle of a road, like excited to see my daughter that's coming up for the first time in 3 months. And this woman draws everybody's attention at the whole checkpoint towards me, standing there with no mask on. And I And I sort of was shocked, and I looked left and right to see. I wasn't quite sure if she was. Yep, she was talking to me, and she screams it again. Get back in your bubble! And I sort of looked around. I went, where does my bubble finish, mate? Where does it start? What am I doing? And this cop comes, charges up to me with his hand resting on his holster,
no,
and pointing at me,
no,
and saying, get back in your bubble. And I went, okay, mate, but where is my bubble? What are you talking about? And he goes, get back there by the it was the spotlight that was on the and I stood back there, and then he comes up and he says, what are you here for? And he gives me the drill, and I said, I'm here for my daughter. Daughter's coming up here. I haven't seen her in 3 months. Blah blah blah. Her mum's about to get here now. Right. Now, all of these people saw this. People that were sitting in the traffic, people that were signing forms, other parents who were sitting on the side of the road in the same situation as me, waiting to see their kids and stuff. And he made me turn around and face north. So I got in the car and turned around and faced north. He said, stay in your car until your daughter turns up. Okay. So that happens. And the mum gets out. This all happened very, very quickly. It was right on the spot. My daughter's mum turns up, and she gets out of the car, and I thought, this is going to be interesting. They get out, both have a massive embrace in front of everybody, full proper hugging embrace, and then my daughter walks straight up to me and gives me a hugging embrace. Like, the bug was obviously transferring from south to north by now. And I turned around and I looked at the cop, I looked at the warden, and I smiled at the other parents who were sitting there. They were all in a state of various forms of smiling, disbelief, frowning, all sorts of different stuff. I looked back at the cop and I just shook my head, and I got back in the car and we drove north and carried on. But that was a very eye-opening experience.
It's your memories now, back to then. It's important we talk about it because it's hard to believe.
Totally.
And when I was a kid, I'd struggle. How could these wonderful German people be Nazis? Easy as.
Oh, big time. And people don't, and a lot of people take offense to that analogy, but it's totally true.
Totally true.
Good little Germans.
And they were doing without thought, and they loved demonizing behavior and demonizing people. So get back in your bubble, right? Ah, but you see, I listened to Tucker Carlson and Naomi Wolf talk, and they made an observation, or they articulated an observation that was sort of circulating in my mind, but I hadn't articulated it. That the crazy thing about this is it actually took the Nazis years and years to get tyrannical control. We went under tyrannical control all in the West in a couple of days.
Incredible, isn't it?
Well, their conclusion was that there was a supernatural force, like a demon. Demons entered. And when this woman's screaming at you to get back in your bubble, when the cop sitting there resting his hand on a handgun and setting up a checkpoint in New Zealand to cross from one area to another, they're not thinking. They're not normal. And the thing is, you can imagine them doing it reluctantly because it's just my job, mate, right?
Yep.
They weren't doing it in that manner. They were over the top loving it. And it was like dealing with a cult or like Hitler Youth or Red Guards. They were just under the spell of this cult, right? It was the weirdest thing. True?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
How would it have gone if you'd been an alcoholic through this period? Like, not had been an alcoholic, alcoholic still drinking through this period.
So, well, that was the first year. So first lockdown, I lasted a year. So I last, the first lockdown I turned into I went for it. I stocked up, if you can imagine. I stocked up big time when they said we were going into our first month-long lockdown, and I ran out within a week and a half. And then they started, so I was very relieved when they started saying that the alcohol shops were allowed to do deliveries. So by this stage, I was topping right back up, and that lasted a year. So I was a drinker for the first year, and then it was when the story that we talked about at the beginning, that was, and so we're talking 2021 now. And
of
then,
course, yeah, I and then appreciate everything, it.
So the veil, so I actually, I took the mickey out of the whole thing for the first year, and I was a drinker and I was making jokes about it and helping people get through on the local pages and what have you. I was a bit of a cheeky bugger. I used to pun on websites a lot, on the news websites. I'd myself and a really clever bugger called Rory used to have pun wars on Stuff News websites and News Hub, and they stuff got involved for quite a while. They got right into it before COVID. And then, so I knew it was absurd, but I went along with it for the first year. But it wasn't until I went down the rabbit hole and started looking into it that things started.
I hadn't appreciated, I'm sorry, that you went through the first lockdown as a drinker, and then, of course, now get the dates right, then you became sober, and then you're still in the midst of the madness, and then the mandates.
So it was when I started looking into. Sorry,
did your drinking go up under lockdown?
Oh, big time! And I got a lot done. So when people say they got a lot done, you hear all these stories of people say it was a fantastic time. I got closer with people. I got a lot done around the house. Oh, I was definitely one of those. I didn't get a lot closer with people, but I got a lot done around the house. I built a lot, made a lot. I got fully involved on the property and what have you. I got a hell of a lot achieved, but it was. Now all of a sudden it wasn't at work. I was drinking all day, every day for 31 days straight that first lockdown. That was me. I counted the days. I can't remember exactly how long the lockdown was. I think that's right. But that was me anyway. I drank for 31 days straight, and it was me. My body couldn't, didn't want to be sober again. So it was all or nothing sort of thing. I've been a bit like that my whole life, actually, to be honest. But then you start looking into it. It's one of the things I wrote down. So I started looking into these people, and like I say, in Africa and what have you, and you start looking at these things that people are talking about. And I began forwarding the concerns of people like Naomi Wolf and Linda Horton, Pierre Corey, Peter McCullough, Ryan Cole, Brett Weinstein, just to name a few. And what I wrote, as their concerns and analysis started stacking up against the mainstream media narrative, I started losing any trust, and I started taking it on board myself and started trying to decipher this stuff myself, and I became public about it myself. And I wish none of it ever happened, but I would never take it back. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Too much has happened, too much has growth, too much, not just me, but for so many people. And sitting here talking to you and anyone,
But isn't it great that we weren't cowards?
I think that during this period, I have long held the belief that the main element missing from all of us has been courage.
Yes.
The main element that's been missing from people to be able to put an end to this or manage this or whatever is courage. And I discovered that I didn't have much in me before, but I had the capacity to have some, and that it built very quickly as the
stuff started. And how courage is, to coin a phrase, infectious. Because you see Linda Wharton, you see Voices for Freedom, people standing up, waving signs, and you become braver.
Absolutely. And you watch people go through suffering and what have you. People who have, like, this is I found fascinating. So many people with so much, although you said before there was absolutely all walks of life down at the protest, and there was absolutely all walks of life, rich, poor, and everything in between. But I found it very fascinating how many people in the community kept quiet.
Yes.
How many people in positions of power who did have money, who did have the ability and means and what have you. And I am not particularly, I'm not in a particular position of wealth or anything. And I was quite happy to lose the little that I had to keep, to stop kids from getting jabbed. So I got into this on from selfish means. Alcohol, I got into this. It was a lot of me at the beginning, but I stuck on the train. My resolve was fortified when I started seeing the kids getting jabbed, and they can't speak for themselves.
And that when they came for the kids with the jab, that was a level of evil, because you knew they had no risk from COVID.
I did a big write-up on this. People started asking me about, because I had become vocal and I had been up till all hours of the night, and people started and knew that I had been, whether or not they believed me, they knew that I had looked into another side of the story. So some people would ask me, what have you found on kids? And so we sort of touched on that a little bit before. But when I went right and dug into the States stuff, they were like weapons to the thing. Kids' bodies were just bumping the bug off, no problem, absolutely no problem, unless they were very, very sick. So when New Zealand Rugby League and Auckland Rugby League put out a mandate or whatever saying that children above 5 had to take the jab in order to be able to go out on the footy field, and I played league for 8 years. I played for Glenora for 8 years, and my father was a sports reporter for the New Zealand Herald and sports editor for quite some time. So I met a lot of these people, and they gravitated around a lot of these people. And when these are the heroes of mine. These people were like big, strong, statuesque heroes of mine. And they were demanding that children had to take a vaccine for something that they were more at risk of the vaccine from. I absolutely didn't put up with it, and I did, I posted on Auckland Rugby League and New Zealand Rugby League, and I was scathing, absolutely scathing, as good as I could in the words that I could. Once I started standing up against my heroes, I sort of never really looked back. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. It's like they were sacrificing kids in some pagan ritual.
To all keep their positions and their paychecks and whatever, to keep their status in community, to keep their whatever it was that they deemed important.
Remember when it was reported by officials that COVID might have got into the country on a frozen chicken, and there'd be an outbreak and the supermarket would do, quote, a deep clean. And anyone could look at that and say, it's a respiratory disease. It's born in the air. It's an aerosol. What on earth are you doing this deep clean? But every spokesperson, every bureaucrat, every little petty council officer, every policeman went along with it. And then hand sanitizer, like that makes a difference, all went along with it. A meter, masks, all went along with it. They were overcome with something like a madness. And you and I, and probably most of our listeners, we were just apart from it, bewildered. And you think that you could write something and post it, and people say, oh, yeah, and I hadn't thought of that. Or here's the data. Here's the emergency use provisions. Oh, here's how a death certificate gets made. Oh, I knew this one right from the get-go. I knew that the lockdown was illegal because for some reason in the back of my brain, probably my time in Parliament, I knew that controversially in the Health Act, and we'd had it from years and years and years, the ability to quarantine. And, of course, it's a big deal. We had the ability for if a ship turned up in World War II or whatever and there's some terrible disease on it, we could just run a ring around that ship and lock it up, quarantine it. We never had a provision for locking up healthy people, putting them in hotels, locking them in their house. Never. It was never imagined. So I knew that was totally unlawful without even needing to check it because just common sense. What do you think will happen?
With?
What happens now? Because we're still carrying it, you and I.
Still carrying?
Well, the bewilderment.
I had somebody say to me the other day, this is a common comment, so I'm not going to lump it on this one person. You guys got consumed. We were able to carry on with our lives. We were able to, like, why didn't you just take the vaccine? By the way, I love Latin now, and it is very apparent to me why Latin has been pulled out of schools and what have you. It's just incredible to be able to, has been a very, very helpful tool over some of this. Just take the vaccine. And I would say, well, do you know what a non sequitur is? It means does not logically follow. You don't just take a vaccine because you've been told to, because you're allowed to carry on with your life and what have you. And they go, yeah, but you got consumed. We all got to carry on with our lives. You got consumed and you're still consumed now. And the other day I said, to the death. Which was, and I'm going to keep saying it now, actually, because it defused the situation. It defused the conversation the other day, and has since. I've used it once again since. And to be honest, I just told my sister this the other day. I feel like if I got hit by a truck later on today, and I ended up having my funeral and I'm hovering. If there's any truth to this Pearly Gate stuff and you're hovering above your funeral and
it's totally true.
And people are there talking about you and what have you and what have you. I now feel less scared of death because of the actions that I've taken in the last 3 years.
Same.
And I can't put a price on that.
Same.
I actually feel like I've had purpose in my life, a whole heap of things that I have my failings in life that I haven't achieved, that I beat myself up for and whatnot. I feel like I'm on a path to making Same. Up for, that I will never make, I will continually try and make up for. And I can't put a price on any of that.
No, same. I said to the Voices for Freedom ladies, I used to call them girls, but I thought that's a bit rude, ladies, that I have no interest in being in politics or political leader or being anything high up. But if they need a body, a living body, to lie in front of a police car or a truck or whatever, I'll be the first to volunteer. And it's an amazing feeling because I worked out through that COVID thing, there's things worse than dying.
Definitely.
And submitting to that shit and having them, I mean, it was so dire, we had to have our kids trained because we got fearful that they'd try and secretly jab them at the school because the principal was nutty on it. And we had them trained how to break an arm lock, how to break an arm and to run. And you're sending your kids off to school saying, whatever happens, do not accept any jab. And my middle girl loves to fit in, and she just told everyone she'd had the jab just to get over the ostracization. But my other kids, my oldest daughter's called Liberty, and they said, "Do have you got the jab?" She says, "My name's Liberty. Do you think I'd take a jab just because the state tells me to?"
Brilliant.
Isn't that great? We didn't get onto your marriage, but I don't want to go over a hurt time. But we know.
It was for, I think it's working out for the best. We do get on really well. And right. For the kids, we get on really well. And I'm very proud of my kids' mum, for regardless of everything that we went through, for sticking to it, because all three of my kids, including my oldest, didn't take it. And there's lots of reasons we don't need to go into why I'm very proud of all of that. I am very proud of her for sticking to it. It wasn't easy for her.
But it's the pressure that everyone was under, right? That's your point. We came under intense social pressure, and there were cracks and there were strains that never before had we had to endure, and things broke, families broke.
Yes, I'd say, actually, I do remember a moment. Because I was intense about it. Well, and appropriately now, I look back, appropriately intense about it. My wife walked out of the room. My 18-year-old was sitting there. She saw a very hard exchange between the two of us. My wife walked out of the room, and I'm not a big fan of letting my emotions take control of me in front of my kid, but I covered my face as tears started coming out my eyes. And my daughter, then 15, she goes, "I don't think you're crazy, Dad." And I looked up at her and cried more, to be honest, as soon as she said that. And I just went, "Why? Why don't you think I'm crazy?" And she goes, "That's the funny the things that kids pick up on." She goes, "That clip that you played me the other day of," it was Brett Weinstein, "of Brett Weinstein talking about the interventionist theory, Tree of Solutions, and how during COVID we ring-fenced during interventionist theory, you go for the lowest hanging fruit, whether it's a changing a tire or a pandemic. You go for the lowest hanging fruit to be able to, the lowest abundant hanging fruit to be able to solve the problem, easily reachable from ground. And as you start to strip the tree from its most reachable, you have to start being able to reach your way up and what have you." Well, he said, "We ring-fenced that tree and put security around it and police around it. Nobody was allowed to touch the low-hanging fruit, and we went and constructed a high-powered cherry picker to be able to go and be able to create some fantasy from the top and what have you." And she just said, "That made so much sense to me, that they were all of these things that we know that we could use to be able to bolster our immune systems and what have you were not being allowed to be used and what have you." And my 15-year-old took that on.
And our kids are awake to it from here on in.
Wicked, eh?
And with Voices for Freedom, with Reality Check Radio, we've built a community. They won't be able to pull this stuff again. They'll do it. They'll try. It'll be something else. They'll try.
We know.
But we know who we are. We know that we're talking. We know our resolve now. And I think one by one, New Zealanders are regaining their minds.
I completely agree.
One by one.
I think that term, the consciousness shift. I've heard that term being used by people who are spiritual through to people who are academics, that there is a consciousness shift happening at the moment, that people are asking questions about normal basic things, from how do they take the caffeine out of coffee while keeping all its flavour, to, which is fascinating when you look into it, by the way, and yuck. And to what's been done to our skies, to all sorts of stuff that people are actually starting to wake up. I say, I don't want to wake up, but there's a consciousness shift happening amongst a whole.
And we'll never, ever regard politicians, officials, government, the media, the medical profession, every profession, rugby league authorities, will never hold them in unquestioned regard again.
Totally. And that's thanks to, I mean, you know, without brown nosing, again, like you just said, reality check, Voices for Freedom, yourself. Thank you very much, Rodney.
Oh, you're going.
Honestly, there's too many names to mention. I've mentioned some here already, but definitely there's too many names to mention, and I don't want to leave anybody out.
No, it's too many.
But the amount of people who I will consider after this, thank you, all of you who have helped me big time, and I will continue to do as much as I can to help. Mm. I get a lot of people coming. I mean, I've just turned 40. Well, 41 now. I've just turned 40, so of course I'm going to these 40th now a lot, and you can imagine some of the conversation that I'm getting about it, because I've been very public. And some of the reactions that I'm getting from people are just, they bring tears to my eyes. That makes me make all of this worth it. From people that are having part of that consciousness shift, I suppose, that are waking up and starting to pay attention, which, by the way, I think is the top tool. If I was to leave with one comment, I would say that the biggest tool that anybody can use, probably in life, really, is paying attention. Anybody can pay attention. It doesn't matter if you're down and out. It doesn't matter who you are in society, as high as you are or as low as you are. Paying attention is one of the biggest tools that we can use to be able to navigate life, let alone what's just happened in the last few years. Anybody can pay attention. And as soon as you're paying attention and using your intuition, it's very, very hard to get fooled. And I think that what you just said is very true. We will not get fooled like that again. Which probably makes us a threat.
Yeah.
I'm very thankful that you've actually contacted me.
We have each other's back.
I'm really glad that you guys or contacted me. And there's a lot of people that I'll be considering and thinking about after this.
Yes. Well, I've become a Christian through this show. And it may not mean much to you, but it's important, because you'll be in my prayers. And people used to say that to me, and I say, oh, that's nice. But their prayers worked for me. And so I want you to be good and strong, Maddie.
Thanks. Cheers.
And thank you for being on our show and sharing your story in two parts, as you say, the alcoholism and the COVID, with us, for being upfront and honest and reminding us of what it was like. You're on Reality Check Radio. That was Maddie Jessop. I feel as though I've relived it all. Wonderful, wonderful man, a good man, and a good father, and brutally honest. I think I'd like Maddie back. Let me know what you think. 2057, email me at inbox@radleycheck.radio.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.